Hi, everybody. I just want to welcome you to the Austin Music Matters session. While we're getting set up, just want to say this is the session where we're going to highlight some fun, entertaining facts and history about Austin music. My name is Lauren Cada. I'm an archivist here in Austin, and on behalf of my boss, Mark Duffy, who is this year's program co-chair, and the program committee, we want to thank you for selecting this lunchtime session to come and enjoy yourself during your lunch. While we're waiting, I'll also take this opportunity to introduce our panelists today and thank them for coming to share their knowledge and their ear and eye candy with us. Today we will be hearing from three panelists. Our first speaker will be Harold McMillan. Harold is the founder and director of Diverse Arts, which is an Austin nonprofit organization. He's the producer of multidisciplinary art and culture projects and programs here in Austin. Harold is involved and active in Austin's art and music community. He has been for the past 20 years, known primarily for his efforts to provide access and exposure to traditions derived from African American culture and other forms of artistic expression outside the classical European tradition. Harold's professional tenure in Austin has been spent almost entirely in the nonprofit sector, in service and management positions in higher education, art and culture, social work, and low-income housing programs. He holds a BSW in social work from East Texas State University, and his graduate training is in administration and planning in the Graduate School of Social Work at University of Texas at Austin. In addition to his work as director of Diverse Arts, Harold McMillan recently was a visiting scholar at the University of Texas as part of the UT Humanities Institute Community Sabbatical Fellowship Program. He, in 2007, was inducted into the Austin Arts Hall of Fame and is a recipient of the 2009 Bridging Divides Award from the University of Texas Project on Conflict Resolution. So thank you for being here today, Harold. We're also going to be hearing from Tim Hamblin, who is the video archivist at the Austin History Center. Always interested in music from a very early age, Tim saw the Beatles when he was 12 years old. He was the treasurer of the Catholic Youth Club, and as treasurer, he got to buy the records for the Friday night dances. He heard about Austin music from a friend when he was living in Dominica in the West Indies. So he came to visit in 1979, check out the music scene in person, and he's still here. He worked in Austin's first used record store, Recycled Records. He worked as a stagehand at the University of Texas Frank Irwin Center for several years, and during that period, he produced a music video show titled Videot's Choice, which aired on Channel 10 for 13 years and also produced several award-winning videos of local musicians. In 1994, he was co-founder and artistic director for the Austin Music Network. Austin Music Network was a 24/7 video music channel run by the city as an economic development tool for the burgeoning local music scene here. In 2000, he became the video archivist at the Austin History Center, a great job that he holds today. He's also a board member of the Texas Music Museum and the South Austin Museum of Popular Culture. Our final panelist speaker today is John Wheat. John Wheat is sound archivist at the Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas here in Austin, where he oversees the center's extensive collections of music and the spoken word. A professional librarian, historian, translator, musician, radio announcer, and lecturer, Wheat brings a wide range of experience to his efforts to document the development of music and the music industry as part of the historical experience of the American people. He has worked extensively with the center's collections of field recordings and other materials gathered by folklorists such as John and Alan Lomax and John Henry Falk during the 1930s and 1940s. During the past 30 years, he has incorporated this material into programs, exhibits, and lectures of his own creation, in addition to helping other scholars in their research. John Wheat is a graduate of the University of Texas Institute of Latin American Studies. He also holds advanced degrees in history from Stanford University and from the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. So these are our speakers today who will be sharing their knowledge and some interesting and entertaining clips of music here in Austin. So again, thank you for coming. Welcome. So I'm finished speaking now that you know who will be speaking. We're going to start with Harold, and each speaker is going to introduce what they've brought to show us today and then play their clips. And hopefully, I know we started a little bit late, hopefully we'll have some time at the end. So sit back, relax, eat your lunch, and enjoy. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Is this one getting out? Yeah. I'm happy to be here to share some material from kind of an ongoing archival project that I direct called Austin Blues Family Tree, which I founded in 1989-1990. And the idea behind the project was that Austin, being known as a music city for years in scholarship and in popular publications and in the media, there really was not a lot said about pre-integration black music in Austin. Most people didn't know about that stuff in terms of where the roots of the blues and jazz community originated in Austin. And in Austin, that's East Austin. So part of what I'm going to show you is a produced piece that we did several years ago that was compiled using materials from the archival work that we had done, but some other sources here in Austin, and I guess we'll show 10 or 12 minutes of it, and then I'll tell you a little bit more. Glad you're here.
And Von Rich. This type of music is the only creation that the United States or that America has given to music that we can say that we donated this art form. This is the only art form that we've given. And we are letting it slide through our fingers just like we let everything else. You know, and essentially it was a black creation, a black art form. And black people have totally lost it. Inside the bucket, and through the holes in the bait bucket, the light would flow. And now I play under crystal chandeliers in the Radisson Hotel. So that's been quite a change. I've seen changes and that have been just tremendous, not only in the music field but all of Austin. They're getting back to cocktail pianists. For a while it was a little slow and they wanted all hard rock or rock and roll or the jazz and that type of thing, but I see a lot of my friends fans that came to see me years ago, they come back and they want to sit in a lounge and be able to listen to quiet music and songs that they came up with.
cocktail, and one of the teachers there, he was transferred from Rockdale to Bartlett, Texas, which is about 40, 50 miles from Rockdale. And so he knew that I was trying to play and get, you know, I played a little bit around the school there, you know, that three or four of us up together. And Yvetta Young, she was teaching that. So he was telling her about it. And she said, well, I feel I want to ride down to Rockdale, see if I can locate him, a blues guitar player. So she did. I couldn't play about one, I couldn't play that good one number, you know, but she was carried away with what I was doing. And so she said to me, said, I'm going back to Austin, and so I'm going to see if I can't get you in Austin, you know. And I said to myself, oh, no, I'm not ready. And sure enough, she did. So she came back to Austin, and three or four days later, here comes Johnny Holmes, you know. Said, I'm from Austin, Texas, and I heard that he played the blues, and I needed a blues player. And that's how I got to Austin, through Johnny Holmes and Yvetta Young. And been right here ever since. Out to different clubs, you know, Johnny most had the weekend. So I started going to Odessa, Midland, and Wake was good out there doing the oil boom. So after Victorville started kind of going down, I came through here and I talked to Johnny Holmes. And I carried Johnny Holmes out there, and he didn't even come back, he stayed. That's what Johnny did, and then after that, well, Johnny would call me, and I would go out there and stay a year or two and play around with the group he had. Then I would come back to Austin, play here a year or two, and maybe go back. That's the way I did it up until about 58. Then I came back in, and I stopped traveling. In Odessa. But this time.
Okay. What you were watching, like I said, came from this project called the Blues Family Tree Project, and the notion was that if we did oral history interviews with the core group of aging African American musicians and asked them to speak about their life and their life in the music business and their life in East Austin, we would end up with some history about the music scene that didn't exist elsewhere. But it was also fairly covert in that if you talk to these guys long enough about their lives, you will talk about politics and race and gender and economics and segregation and desegregation and gentrification. So what we did was, this actually came fairly close to the beginning of the project. The idea was that, by and large, there was not a documentary trail for most of the folks that we talked to for this project. There are publications on the east side of town that had been up and down for years, but when I first started this, if you went to the morgue of the American Statesman and did a search for T.D. Bell, you wouldn't find very much, or for Robert Shaw. If you find more about Robert Shaw, and I know that I'm throwing out names that are unfamiliar to you, but basically what I'm saying is that the public record out there, and in scholarship, it wasn't there. So the task that we took with this project was to start at the beginning with a core group of oral histories, transcribe those, match a lot of keywords, do cross-referencing to build a larger narrative, but then take the next 8 or 10 years to annually put up a series of performances that we shot as television shoots, 4 or 5 camera shoots, 3 or 4 camera shoots, hired photographers to shoot black and white archival film, audio recorded it to digital audio tape. And you do this for 8 or 10 years, and you get to the end of it, and you end up with 150, 200 hours of usable archival material that doesn't exist prior to your doing it. For me and the people that I work with, one of the important things about this project was that the city of Austin, like I said, is known as a music city, and in the 80s and 90s was known as a big blues town because of the infamous Antone's Blues Club. But the point that we were trying to make was that black folks have been listening to and playing blues and jazz in this town since the beginning of jazz and blues, but there's not a record of that. So with this project, we've been able to cobble together part of that story. There's still a lot of work that can and needs to be done. Probably a third of the people that appear in this footage, which we shot, I guess, in 1990, 1991, and 1992, are dead. I mean, that was the point, was that the history was going to die with them unless we did something about that. We are happy to say that now, if you go online, if you've got a laptop right now, and you Google T.D. Bell or Blues Boy Hubbard, probably half of the citations that come up, and there will be several, will be tied back to our project. So we were successful in creating a documentary trail for our community of musicians that prior to that, that didn't exist. And where we are now is that just in the last couple of years, the city of Austin finally, with some prodding, has designated a cultural heritage district in Central East Austin. So now we are expanding this project to try to provide some documentation of the cultural content of that geographic area, of that district. And our ultimate plan is for that to turn into a virtual cultural district online so that there's a digital archive that exists of this community. Thank you for your attention.
Hi, I'm Tim Hamblin, the video archivist at the Austin History Center. And would first of all like to thank you all for coming, and thank you all for whoever it was brought the rain, because after 55 days of 100-degree weather, we really appreciate the rain. So whoever brought it, we appreciate that. And on the subject of thanks, I would like to thank my volunteer, Ginny Rowland, who's in the audience here, who helped put together my piece. And thank all the volunteers and interns who help all the archives get together. It's nice to see that some people that used to work with us as interns and volunteers are here with great jobs. So Thank you, and I'm glad you made it. My story with the Austin History Center is that we inherited the group, the tapes, from the Austin Music Network. That's the main source of our music collection. This was a 24-hour music channel, started in 1994, and I was the artistic director. A lot of these tapes are on 3/4 inch. A lot of them need to be transferred to a digital format. If any of you are in the video archiving field, you know how difficult that is and how uncertain any digital format in terms of preservation is available. So I put together a reel that I think shows the wide reflection of music from Austin. A lot of people think of Austin as just Willie Nelson or just Sleep at the Wheel or other country stuff, but we've had a huge selection. Harold has highlighted some of the early music of Austin or and the East Side Chitlin Circuit music scene that was the most thriving scene in Austin in the early days. And there was a lot of people playing music before some of the major names that we know. As I'm an archivist, one of the things we have to do is a lot of paperwork. So one of the things I'm going to do now is give Harold this deed of gift for a donation he made 4 years ago. So we've been trying to track him down. So here's the deed of gift. We're doing a little business up here.
I feel this
out twice already. It's all part of the job. And that's one of the issues we have with video, is that it's far more difficult to get the rights, the people to sign off on them. People give you stuff and say, yeah, you can use it. And then we find out there's 10 other entities that have interest in it. But part of our job, I think, is to preserve it and make it accessible, and hopefully through the web and other contemporary medium, this is going to be possible. And hopefully the lawyers won't try and stop us too much. So without further ado, I will get you to start playing this disc, okay. And then at each stop I will make a little comment. So this starts off the intro with Mariachi Relampago. I think you can beat having 20 or more musicians on stage playing. I think that was a great start. And this is something that I think you might appreciate. This is Willie from the Porter Wagner Show, circa 1965, pre-beard. I'm not sure whether he was smoking at the time or not, but...
He was.
But he looks like a nice, clean chap. So let's play that one.
The song, this is... brand new one of mine, and She's Not For You.
Wow.
Pay no mind to her. She only wants to play. But she's not for you. She's not for you. So she told you she found heaven in your eyes. Well, I think it only fair to warn you that sometimes she lies, but it's your heart. I can't tell you what to do. But she's not for you. She's not for you.
And next up, we have a little PSA from Daniel Johnston, who started his, some of you may or may not know Daniel Johnston, who basically started his music career here in Austin by coming around to record stores and handing out his cassettes of his music that he recorded on a Radio Shack recorder. And this is actually one that he gave to me from my personal collection on a Radio Shack tape, the cheapest, crappiest tape you could get. But that he went on, he got some claim to fame, or notoriety, should I say, when Kurt Cobain wore one of his t-shirts at one of his gigs, and people started to wonder who this guy was, who used to go around. I had been in the first Waterloo Records, and he was handing out his, and trying to hustle his tapes to the likes of Eric Johnson, the guitarist Eric Johnson, who was like, oh thanks. So now he's had his songs covered by Sonic Youth and numerous other bands. So sadly, Daniel has had some medical problems. But this is a PSA, a very short PSA that was shot in 1986. Let's play that.
This is Daniel Johnston, asking you to don't drink and drive, or smoke either.
Try to make sense out of that.
Yeah, that was, I recorded that, and I'd seen Daniel on the street, and he said, he'd always been asking me to do some video with him, so I said, okay, Daniel, let's go and do some. He had his guitar with him. So we went off to this little house that I was renting for $50 a month as a studio. And he only had 5 strings on his guitar. And I said, Daniel, let's go to the guitar shop down the street. No, this is fine. This is fine. So Daniel is a very unusual person and still is, but he's produced some great music. So this is something that I'm kind of proud of. It's as you can see, Johnny Cash. He was the keynote speaker at South by Southwest in 1994, and he was doing a secret gig at Emo's, and I went with another camera person to shoot some, like a news footage deal on this, and it turned out that no one was stopping us shooting, so what, we were going to shoot a couple of minutes, and so we kept shooting. So this is a little segment from the end. But if you'd like to see the whole half-hour show, we currently have an exhibit at the Austin History Center. It's 5 blocks away, 810 Guadalupe. It's called Not a Museum. We're an archive. And you can see the whole half-hour show there, should you be interested, if you can make it down there. Johnny Cash.
You said now you just fought one hell of a fight, and I know you hate me. You got the right to kill me now, and I wouldn't blame you if you do. But you ought to thank me before I die for the gravel in your gut and the spit in your eye, because I'm the son of a bitch that made you sleep. I got all choked up, and I threw down my gun. I called him a ball, and he called me a son. Come away with a different point of view. Now I'm dead, every time I tried, every time I went. If I ever have another boy, I'm gonna name him Emo.
I thought you'd appreciate that. And you can still go down to Emo's tonight and have fun, but you probably won't see Johnny Cash there. Maybe in spirit, but not. This is an MTV News clip that, back in the day, MTV actually used to pay stringers to produce news clips, and this was one that Joe King thought up. His manager was Joe Nick Potaski, and He had a Queen for the Day competition. So this is a short clip from that, and I think you'll find it entertaining.
Austin, Texas, Joe King Carrasco, the crown prince of Nuevo Huevo, recently gave some of his loyal followers the chance to be queen for a day. Contestants gave one good reason why they should have the honor of being queen. After sifting through hundreds of entries, the judges selected five finalists to compete for the title at a concert held in the Austin Coliseum. The king was in top form. And so were the contestants.
I'm a blonde fox and crazy just like Joe.
Crazy just like Joe.
Finally, it was the crowd that chose the lucky lady. The king was pleased with the crowd's choice. After the show, the queen received gifts of regal splendor, and the happy couple headed straight for the king's favorite cantina for a Tex-Mex feast. Partying with Joe King Carrasco, this is Kevin Kennedy for MTV.
Yeah, that was fun when shooting that. We made him eat about six jalapenos before we said, no, we haven't got the shot right. So. And that was at a place called Jalapeno Charlie's that no longer exists, but it had the hottest food, hotter than anywhere else. Everything was hot or hotter. Next up, we have a little piece, from, which is a tribute to Robert Shaw, who Harold mentioned earlier. And it features an intro by Dr. Hepcat, who was actually the first African-American DJ on radio here. And he had such cool lingo and was just the guy that, the jive. He had the jive and was very cool. So here's a little bit of that.
The music in Texas, it's just different from other music. You have a feeling that you're part of the music, that you're part of the song, you're part of the country, you're part of the air.
Some come and cry, some coming about to scream. Hollin' mercy, what do mercy mean?
The blues songs that I write, they sort of built on experience. I on use of time, one phrase of the black experience, you know, hard times, unable to get a job. You're deep in love with your family and with your wife and things, and you can hardly support her, you know. And then wouldn't allow too much education because you'd probably get too smart. So the only thing you can do, we could do after working all day, it's probably on Saturdays, and it's go to a Saturday night supper and hear the guitar players, and just that was sort of a social outlet. See?
Yeah, that's a great documentary that. Hopefully we'll be able to get that online sometime soon. That actually features John Wheat talking in there. Yeah. And I have footage of Harold as well, so I've got everyone covered. But there was nothing embarrassing. It was all cool. Next up, we have The True Believers. It was shot at the back room. And this is interesting because it has Alejandro Escovedo, who is now getting increasingly popular here and across the nation, and John D. Graham. Unfortunately, you can't see John D. Graham in this little clip, but he was playing there. And the True Believers were one of the hardest rocking bands in Austin. And this is from 1985 at the back room.
Too long, trying to keep my word, but nothing now.
Yeah, the True Believers are actually fantastic live, really, a really, really together band, except for there were three main guitarists, and they were all turned up to 11, so you really knew you were listening to them when you saw them. This is a short little promo from Rocky Erickson, and for those of you that don't know, Rocky Erickson was in the 13th Floor Elevators. That was basically one of the first psychedelic bands to exist, and based in Austin. And again, he was someone who had mental issues and drug issues and other things. But this is, I think, this is him with his son doing a promo for the Austin Music Network.
Hey, my name is Jago Erickson. And this is Rocky Erickson.
And what is this, man? This is something good, right?
You're watching the Austin Music Network.
What?
Say who you are, and say who he is, and then he's going to go, you're watching the Austin right. Music Network.
Got that?
Okay, you got it?
What are you watching?
All right. They're telling me that this is some kind of deal that for what we're doing. Is that right?
That's right.
You think that is? Huh? So I'm just going to trust you. It isn't like cable mags, is it? It isn't like cable mags, is it?
My name is Jago Erickson, and this is my dad, Rocky Erickson.
And this is the Austin Music Network!
Hey, we did our thing.
Is that all right? Did I do good?
Good.
Bless you. All right.
Thank you.
All right.
And bless you too, Rocky. Yes. And Rocky's doing a lot better these days and performing, and definitely worth watching if you get a chance to see him. Next up, couldn't include this tape without some Stevie Ray Vaughan. And this is relatively unique because it features Stevie playing with the fabulous Thunderbirds and his brother Jimmy Vaughan also there. You'll also notice that unfortunately Stevie probably wouldn't like this because he doesn't have his hat on. He'd been playing behind his hat, knocked his hat off. But if you look at the very end of the clip, he's got his hat back on. So, and you can see it on the stage. So let's see a little bit of Stevie Ray Vaughan. Okay, this is another MTV news clip, and this is when Charlie Sexton was called Little Charlie Sexton because he was 13. And it's him playing with the Joe Ely Band. And for those of you that are Dylan fans, Charlie played guitar with Dylan for about 3 years, a couple of years back, and actually just played with him last week. So he's done quite well for himself. So I think this was fairly prophetic news story, so watch this.
Most 13-year-olds only dream of playing with a rock band, but for young Charles Sexton, known as Little Charlie, the dream has become a reality, as for the next few weeks he'll be touring with one of the hottest acts in Texas, the Joe Ely Band.
So I thought of somebody that would be completely unexpected, you know, that people would never figure that would get a 13-year-old guitar player.
I guess we just kind of met, you know. I played with him a couple times. And Jesse broke his hand, fought the wall, and I got the job.
Little Charlie's chance to go on tour came about when Jesse Taylor, Joe Ely's regular lead guitarist, broke his hand.
He got up on stage with us, and we'd never seen him or heard of him either, and
He just blew us away, and this was when he was 11, which would be, what, 2 years ago.
Some might feel that being on the road with a band is definitely not a suitable lifestyle for a 13-year-old, but little Charlie seems to take it all in stride. Band manager Chet Hansen.
He loves getting on stage. He sparkles, you know, as soon as he gets up there.
And if audience reaction is anything to go by, little Charlie will continue to spend a lot of his time under the bright lights in the future. Looking at the younger side of rock and roll, this is Kevin Kennedy for MTV.
So he did spend, or has been spending, quite a lot of his time under the bright lights with Bob Dylan and the likes. Next up is a really cheesy music video, but I love it. It's Doug Simon, it's a Douglas Quintet, Down on the Border, from 1983, and this is when they made videos for fun, before MTV ruined everything. So this is just a clip from it, but I think you'll get the idea. They don't make them like that anymore, sadly. Okay, this next little clip is from a live show that was produced during South by Southwest in 1989. So that would have been the third one, I believe. And it's the interviewers are Joe Nick Petoskey and Bill Crawford. They co-wrote the book on Stevie Ray Vaughan. But they were pretty goofy in this little show. And this contains an interview with Roland Swenson, who is still the managing director of South by Southwest, and Louis Myers, who booked all the entertainment and was a co-director. And it's interesting to them talking about, do they think they bottomed out? Do they think it's going to continue? So they're now in their 24th year. So let's see what they have to say. But this is goofy.
Is a co-director of the conference and the director of the music festival. So any of you bands out there who have some questions for Lewis.
Can I get one of those blurry things?
I'll do that real quick.
No, so has it been a success? Has it reached the high heights and the low lows that you hoped?
It's definitely reached the low lows. I think last night we reached the lowest low. And I'll publicly apologize to Jim here for the sound system problems at his show on Friday. We had a lot of technical problems.
Well, Lewis, this is a question.
Sorry,
well, if you're working with 10 cans of string, what do you expect?
I'm sorry, Jim.
This is a question that's been on a lot of people's minds in Austin. Have we bottomed out?
Did we have flock of seagulls last night? Does it answer your question?
Hey, I like their hair, dude. I like their hair, dude.
In my opinion, yeah, that's we bought them down. Everything will be better.
Hey,
yeah.
dollars and cents. We're not going to get any figures. I know this is kind of a thing between you all, but sold out of club.
Very impressive. Very impressive.
Yeah.
Except why didn't you print more? Yeah.
Well, we didn't think we'd sell that many. And
good.
Some of the figures have been bandied about are kind of inflated.
What are the real figures?
$10 million, 15 million armbands sold.
We made hundreds of dollars.
Okay, where are you guys going on vacation next week? This always usually tells me whether the festival. Come on.
I'm going to Aquawina Springs.
Lewis, you're a little tight-lipped.
I'm hoping for Pease Park. If I'm lucky, Zilker would be really a great three-day adventure.
Well, no, but really, putting all seriousness aside, you guys have done a really good job, and I want to hear.
Okay, that was silliness from 1989. The conference is still going, and they seem to be quite successful. Finally, I'm going to finish up with one of my favorite bands of the era, which was the Big Boys, which was a punk band. They were kind of the focus of the punk movement here in Austin that was actually very big in America, they incorporated all the clothes ripping and the fun, but without the aggression, although if you watch this, it looks like there could be a little trouble, but no one was hurt in the course of this video, and then it'll end up with credits. So thank you very much, and have fun while you're here.
That's a hard act to follow. I'm John Hui, once again, from the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History at the University of Texas at Austin. So I represent the big state university here on this panel. The name History Center doesn't suggest immediately music collections. Not every history center is devoted to that. As a matter of fact, one of the first lessons you learn is that in many cases, the direction that collection building takes in a particular institution is often dependent entirely upon who is there at the time, who's the director, who are the personnel, what are their priorities and interests. It so happened when I came to the History Center, 1978, there was no music collecting going on, really, so to speak. But then we had a new director who's now still our director, came on in about 1980, and he was an urban historian, very much interested in media, music, and all of that. And because I came from a background in radio before I was at the History Center, he said, why don't you be in charge of sound archives and start seeing what we've got here? And as I started surveying, the first thing I discovered was John A. Lomax field recordings sitting on the shelves all boxed up and nobody paying any attention to them. This is a very familiar story, probably in many archives. You've got some precious music there and nobody pays any attention to it. Well, I paid attention to it, and I suggested to my director that why don't we start collecting Texas music systematically and as comprehensively as possible. Everything. Any kind, any form, any genre of music. So to make a long story short, we did that. Since the early 80s, we've been collecting Texas music seriously and built up quite a body of research materials of all kinds about Texas music and music of the greater South and Southwest, because our collections transcend the borders of Texas in many ways. We're not just music. I'm not going to bother you with all the other things we've got there, but we are a music center. The type of music that we collect, as I say, is all genres. Everything from cowboy ballads to urban punk music or rap, for example. A lot of hip-hop and rap music happening in Houston, Austin, other southern cities under that name, Dirty South. You know, a lot of energy and creativity going into that type of music as well. We're interested in all of it. Folk and popular music, for the most part, that's ever been practiced in Texas and the region at any time. And not only are we trying to document music and its artists and the styles and the development of all these different genres of music, we're also interested in documenting the music industry itself. All of the things that make music happen, all of the things that shape the way music is heard by the public. This includes everything from recording studios to record companies and their distribution, the media, radio, television, and other media airplay, concert venues, clubs, festivals, and things like that. We're interested in all of those aspects that help shape the development of music in this area. So to that extent, I'm going to go highlight some of collections that we've got. And in the middle, I'm going to stop every once in a while and play some ear and eye candy, as we refer to it here, because I know you came to hear and see stuff. By the way, I'm going to mention a bunch of collections, and you will not be held responsible for memorizing all of these. It will not be on the quiz, so don't worry. You can follow up on a lot of these collections if you check our website at the Center for American History. Look for subject guides on our music collections. All of these are spelled out there. And also the TARO website, that's Texas Archival Resources Online, T-A-R-O. And a lot of our full inventories to the archive collections that have been put on that site are available there. So you can actually search through a lot of these on that site. Among the recordings collections that we have assembled, my favorite one is the Texas Music Collection. It's one that I just created out of the blue. As a DJ coming over from the public radio station here, KUT, I was a Spanish language disc jockey, one of my other little jobs, for 7 years over there doing a program that's still on the air today, thank God, called Horizontes on every Friday. I used to do it 10 hours a week there and in Spanish. And I got lots of DJ copies as a result, as anybody that works in radio gets. Well, I took all of my Hispanic DJ copies I had with me and brought them over there and put them on the shelf and said, voila, this is the Texas Music Collection. Started off with about 700 45s and LPs, and it just started growing from there. Being located in Austin, of course, we have access to lots and lots of musicians and lots of demo records and contributions and whatnot available in Austin. Texas Music Collection is 8,000 to 9,000 recordings now. Ed Ward Music Collection is an LP collection inherited from the music critic Ed Ward, writer for Rolling Stone, Crawdaddy, Village Voice, etc. Moved to Austin for 10 years and of course kept receiving review copies all the time he was here. Moved to Berlin and then left the entire collection to us when they started charging him rent where he had it stored. So we were the beneficiaries of his financial problems. 12,000 to 13,000 LPs of every genre of music collected by a prominent critic, a very valuable collection. Townsend Miller Collection, another one, a local music, country and folk music writer for the Austin American Statesman, and sort of the journalist responsible for the progressive country movement, for popularizing the progressive country movement here in Austin. during the decade of the 70s. His private collection is also over there, very valuable thing. Mance Lipscomb, Glenn Allen collection. Mance Lipscomb was a guitar wizard and blues singer from Navasota, Texas, as they say, discovered by Chris Strachwitz and the White Traveling Recording Company people, and they, of course he became a phenomenon for the several years late in his life that he was a performer. We have a complete collection on his life assembled by a young folklorist who wanted to write his biography. UT Folklore Center archives contains copies of many, many field recordings made by the likes of Américo Paredes, a great border historian, John Lomax for the Library of Congress, William A. Owens doing sort of the same thing here in Texas for the UT Extension Service, and many other collections like that. And as I mentioned, John Lomax, we're going to finally hear our first sound recording here. Among the John A. Lomax papers, which are, add more to the field recordings, a great deal of ballad search correspondence by the great folklorist working for the Library of Congress with his son, Alan, going out and doing these various recordings. One of the things that the Lomax family collected and is part of their collection there are private recordings made by Leadbelly for the family, never issued commercially. So the first little thing I'd like to play for you is a recording that Leadbelly made for the Lomax family in 1935 when John Sr. and Alan were working with him doing recordings in southern prison camps. Incidentally, they found Leadbelly at the notorious Angola prison farm in Louisiana in 1934 and got him furloughed to work with them. So Leadbelly sat down in front of a microphone with his favorite 12-string guitar and made this recording on an aluminum disc back in 1935, which we've had transferred and digitized now. And he's singing about Austin, Texas, and the Lomax family and their house on 400 East 34th Street, where they lived at the time. So it's very specific, and he's just making up verses. And every once in a while, he'll say in a chorus, El Nora, who was the name of the black cook who worked for the Lomax family at that time. And so he was sort of making a tribute to her because she'd been so kind to him. So it's all just made up verses by Leadbelly, never issued, just a private recording for the Lomax family. Let's hear it now. Can you boost that at all? 400 block. Right here in Austin. Anybody should ask you. Who made this song, sir? That big old 12-string guitar he loved to play so much. Those are just made-up verses. I'm sorry the sound level wasn't strong, but I think you were able to pick it up. So this is something that comes in oftentimes in archival collections that you, this little special surprises that you'd never expect to find. There's several recordings like that in the Lomax collection, including three test pressings made for the American Recording Company in New York City in 1935, before Leadbelly ever recorded his first commercial releases on that company under Lomax's direction, I guess. The among other collections we have here, just as samples of the sort of things that we're doing, Bob Johnston collection. Bob Johnston is a Texan, also a super producer who was CBS Records representative in Nashville in the mid-60s. He was the one that brought Bob Dylan to Nashville and recorded, he was a producer for most of Dylan's big-selling albums of that period, Blonde on Blonde, Nashville Skyline, Self-Portrait, Highway 61 Revisited. He produced all of those. In addition to Paul Simon's Parsley Sage, Rosemary and Thyme, and Sound of Silence, he produced both of those albums. Both of the Johnny Cash prison recordings that he did that nobody else wanted to try to handle. Aretha Franklin, Leonard Cohen, he produced everybody you can think of during this whole period. And so his papers are there. The tantalizing thing about the Bob Johnston collection is that there are rows of these 10-inch producers' reels, studio reels there that produce for him. And he doesn't, I don't think he knows what's on every one of them. And I swear there's unreleased Dylan and stuff in there that not even he's aware of it. It has little enigmatic notes on there. Big 10-inch reel that says Dylan. No notes, no nothing else. And so I'm really intrigued about this. And every once in a while, Bob shows up and has some scheme in mind. But I swear there's treasure sitting on that shelf that we're unable to tap into still at this point. Huey Moe is another, there's another Texas character. He just got out of prison again, sort of a notorious character. But he was a super producer in Texas. And you saw Doug Somm, for example. He was the one that discovered Doug Somm. He was the one that, Freddie Fender and all of the people that were in those groups. And produced a ton of other, B.J. Thomas, long list of people that he got started in the recording business. A very controversial character and had lots of problems, but we have essentially, when he got into trouble, the guy handling his estate said, we got to sell all this, and so the university actually went down to Houston with a large truck and cleaned out his entire warehouse and brought it back to Austin. So it's an amazing collection, as you can imagine. Let me finish here. Documenting the music industry, we have the Archives of the Armadillo World Headquarters here. It's one of the institutions that helped put Austin on the musical map in the decade of the 70s. And along with that, the Archives of the Soap Creek Saloon, which is a very popular venue here in Austin. Claude Matthews' collection, a video producer, all about Threadgill's and the musical life at Threadgill's restaurant, which is where Janis Joplin started singing back in the early 1960s when she was an art student at the University of Texas. I was there at the time, I remember. So I would like to take this opportunity now to cue up the next little sound bit to play for you. This is Janis Joplin at Threadgill's circa 1962, singing with the Waller Creek Boys. And this is Janis singing Appalachian ballads. Nobody liked rock and roll back then. They looked down on it because they were intellectuals. They were Jack Kerouac readers and things. And so rock and roll was too commercial and it was bubblegum to them. Pure folk music and Bessie Smith blues were what Janis Joplin was into, and she sang it in that style. Here's Janis. Beer bottles and everything. This is a home tape recorder on a table at Threadgill's. Yeah. you're going to have to endure this harmonica solo. Still learning. I went to junior high with this guy. Okay, here comes Janis back. That's where it all began, right, at Threadgill's in the early 60s. And she left about the mid-60s for San Francisco and became part of Big Brother and the holding company and all the rest of that story. That recording, typically from that period, was of somebody's just private home tape recorders stuck on a table, and then everybody would hand these things around to each other and make copies. So the provenance of this particular recording is very, very cloudy. So I don't know who to attribute it to, but it came from the collection of Jack Jackson, who was one of the people who was in the group that was hanging around with Janis at that time. Okay, since we don't have that much time, I'm going to cut ahead to my last excerpt here and just set it up and let it run for you. This is something else that was never issued commercially, and it was a tragic thing because this is about Selena, the great Tejano singer, who was killed in 1994. And of course, you may have seen the Jennifer Lopez biopic that they did about her life and all that. But she was poised for real greatness along the lines of, say, Gloria Estefan as a Latino superstar about to make it into the mainstream, which she was doing when she died. There was a Spanish teacher here in Austin who I worked with in helping provide the background for this next production. You're going to see a video production. And where Selena was going to act as a teacher in a virtual TV classroom and narrating a video aimed at high school students. And it's all about mi musica, my music, where she explains what Tejano music is and what it means to her, both for the Hispanic students and the non-Hispanic students at whatever school this would be shown. And she starts off the video by urging them all to finish high school and get your diploma. So she's serving as a role model to these students in addition to teaching about the culture that she represents. In this video, we're going to see the part where she talks about what Tejano music is, where it came from, and who listens to it and what it means culturally. So just a short clip from it. What happened when the thing was finally finished, she was killed and the family decided they did not want this ever distributed. So this is my copy that I got from the lady I helped produce it as an advisor on the project. So this is something that can be seen at the archives, but cannot be produced and put on, say, websites and things like that because the family would be in the way. So here's Selena as a high school teacher talking about mi música.
First, the isolation of much of the Mexican population from the rest of Texas allowed for continued identification with Mexico and Mexican music. Monterrey supplied many music teachers and musicians to South Texas. The German immigrants to Monterrey brought the accordion, polka, waltz, and other European dance styles, which became popular throughout Mexico and South Texas. The immigration during the Mexican Revolution helped to strengthen and maintain the Spanish language and Mexican culture in Texas. Among these refugees were highly trained musicians and music teachers. The bottom line is that the Tejanos were able to develop a very distinctive musical style because of their isolation. We'll talk about that best-known style now. Tejano music is known for its use of el acordeón, the accordion, and for the polka ranchera, waltz, and other rhythms of German origin. Tejano music is performed by conjuntos, orquestas, or grupos. Conjuntos have from 2 to 4 members, with 2 members singing in harmony. The principal instrument is the acordeón, accompanied by a bajo sexto, bass, and drums. The guitar-related instruments trace their heritage to Spain. Orquestas are much larger and include brass instruments such as trumpets, wind instruments such as saxophones and clarinets and violins. The acordeón may be included. Grupos are smaller and often use synthesizers to create a brass, string, and even acordeón sounds. Norteño is very similar to Tejano music. Norteño means northern or of the north, northern Mexico in this case. Norteño groups from Mexico have toured Texas for decades and have been strongly influenced by Tejano music and Tejano fans, especially in their style of acordeón playing. Now, who listens to Tejano music and who listens to Norteño music? It doesn't matter where you're from or what part of the country you live in. You can enjoy both. Tejano music is being more widely marketed now in Mexico, so the public will be growing. The taste of the new audience will have an effect on the Tejano style. Tejano and Norteño are meant to be danced at weddings, birthday parties, festivals, tardeadas, concert dances. People like to dance when they've got the chance. Of course, at school dances and parties, we have top 40, R&B, rap, and Tejano. And now, I will show you how to dance a polka. And in Texas, we always move in a circle around the floor. Why? Perhaps this tradition came from Germany along with the polka and waltz. Country western dance in Texas also moves in a circle. Waltzes are not quite as common, but are danced especially at weddings and quinceañeras, debutante parties. Another rhythm that is very popular is the cumbia. It's a kind of música tropical, or tropical music, because it comes from Colombia and has Afro-Colombian roots. We don't play it in the same way as Colombians do. Cumbia came a long way up through Mexico, and we adapted it in Texas. When we dance cumbia, we can dance side by side, or even together. You know, I always feel super cool and really comfortable when I hear Tejano music. It reminds me of home. I love to dance, and it's a nice and relaxed style. Tejano musicians also sing in English, in country western style, and in pop music style. We can do anything because we grow up listening to all kinds of music. Speaking of listening to different music, let's move on to California.
No, let's don't.
Just joking. Anyway.
Yeah, anyway. Right? We don't want to hear about that California stuff. Anyway, so you get an idea of how really valuable this could have been as a teaching tool, and it shows a whole new side of Selena's character and the cultural impact that could have been. Anyway, so I think that's about all I want to try to play for you today. It's been a real pleasure to share these little goodies with you. I know all three of us have really enjoyed this, and we have a little time left for some discussion, feedback, questions, whatnot. I'll open that to you. So thank you very much. If you do have any questions, would you please use the microphone there? Well, all right. It's been great.
Can I just remind you all that Cornell Hurd is playing tonight, and if you haven't seen Cornell Hurd, you will have a wonderful time seeing him. It's very entertaining. And Harold, don't you have a gig coming up soon?
We've got one of my partner producers is at the Victory Grill tonight with a new series called Sold Out, and it's like a breakthrough new artists that are doing original neo-soul. After 8 p.m.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you all for listening.
I will say this, but right now we have